Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Loopcast again. So we're continuing our talks on Iraq, and I'm very happy to have Philip Smythe on the line today, and he is a researcher at the University of Maryland's Laboratory for Computational Cultural Dynamics, and he's also a writer for the Hezbollah Cavalcade, which we will put a link to that under this talk, so I definitely encourage our listeners to go and check out his work there. And we'll also post another article that he's done for WinApp. So welcome to the show, Philip.
Thanks for having me on.
So today I was thinking we could focus on Shiite politics in Iraq, and we can also look at Iran's involvement in Iraq. So why don't you just give our listeners a quick overview of how the Shiite politicians are looking at the situation. When I say situation, I mean the one that's been taking place in the last 2 weeks in Iraq with ISIS invading different parts of the region. So give our listeners a little overview of what the Shiite political, what would be the West word of say, reaction to this has been.
Well, they understand. I mean, simply put, they understand that this is a huge existential threat to their existence, to their political power, to religious holy sites, just about everything that really is of importance to now kind of the newly entrenched, meaning newly empowered Shia community. They are seeing kind of ISIS's advances and, Naqshbandis, the Ba'athist type groups, and other Sunni, quote unquote, rebel groups operating in Iraq. They view it as a humongous threat, but I mean there is a level of nuance to a lot of this, because if we're talking about Iranian proxy groups, not all of them have had the best relationships with other Iraqi Shia parties that are on the ground, and I mean this is translated out to another one of the reasons why these proxy groups are usually aligned with Nouri al-Maliki, and they have found a place by his side. As essentially his, his tip of the spear, his hard power element, so that he can push his interests within the Iraqi, political world among other Shia groups, and also against Sunni foes. So generally speaking, I mean, it's a gigantic crisis, and because it's a gigantic crisis, most people are focused on how to really counter ISIS, and also how to defend their interests. Now, I guess going a little bit off of the Iranian proxies and other groups, kind of a main thing came out recently, where it was Ayatollah Sistani's, who's probably the grandest of the grand Ayatollahs, who's based in Najaf. He's generally a very traditional. People have called him a quietist. I think that's kind of an odd definition, since he has gotten involved in politics every once in a while. He has generally called for Shia not to retaliate against groups like ISIS that have attacked their shrines. If you remember the Askari Shrine, which was attacked in 2006 and again in 2007, he actually called on Iraqi Shia not to retaliate. But he also saw the writing on the wall, and he called for, even he issued a fatwa which said that Iraqi Shia should be joining the Iraqi army, government forces. But it's interesting in a way, because this is also an affront to the kind of operations, if you will, that these Iranian proxies were doing within Iraq. These Iranian proxies were doing within Iraq. Because they had been recruiting people long before and are still recruiting people for their own ranks. And because of that, I mean, by saying, no, you have to go through government forces, it's kind of a way of snubbing that effort, which has been going on much longer than the official government effort.
So there are a lot of concepts on what the source of this current crisis is in Iraq. Of course, we have ISIS, and that's one aspect of it, but there's a lot of things going on in behind the scenes, so to speak. So in your own opinion, what do you see as the source of this current crisis?
We can be here all day for that one. I could go all the way back to Saddam Hussein. It's just, I don't know, a question like that kind of opens it to a lot. But if we're talking recent history, I mean, and I'm talking very, very recent history. One, we had the ascension of Nouri al-Maliki, who essentially handled government in the country as if he were a sectarian, just a sectarian leader trying to secure power and using other sectarian elements to cut out what were essentially opposition groups. So the Kurds, they felt very sidelined. The Sunnis, they felt that they were now under this Shia boot, and they were not really making much headway anywhere. And, I mean, on top of that, the forces, like I mentioned before, that he was using to really keep them down were a mixture of Iranian proxy forces. So for many Sunnis who were watching this, they were looking at it and saying, well, Maliki's nothing but an Iranian stooge because he's using these Iranian groups and, you know, he is kind of kowtowing to their interests. If you remember, the status of forces agreement was never signed mainly because of Iranian pressure. You know, this is why American troops, you know, part of the reason actually why American troops eventually pulled out, even though there were American politicians, Bush included, who did want to pull out American troops. So, I mean, there's that kind of angle to it. But then there's another angle. For ISIS in this crisis, they actually were able to establish a base, a solid base that was not really under all that much threat. They've come to dominate certain chunks of Syria where they have built small economic structures that have supplied them with money. You know, friend and colleague Aaron Zellin, who's, you know, regular Loopcast guy, you know, when I was talking to him, he said that he believes that they're relatively self-sufficient. You know, when you're looking at donors and whatnot, they are not really the main way that ISIS is bringing in cash. So, you know, they were able to set up a good base in Syria. They were able to recruit other foreign fighters because they went through a process of Iraqization, if you will, where they tried to push that they were, you know, fighting specifically in Iraq and for Iraqi interests. I mean, a lot of people, I've heard this comment from some people where they go, can you believe that ISIS just advanced into Iraq and, you know, acting as if they were not constantly attacking targets in Iraq? And they were. They were bombing marketplaces. They were attacking Shia on pilgrimages. They were attacking this. They were attacking that. They were attacking government, you know, installations and also government soldiers. So, you know, this has been going on for a while, but Syria really gave them this place, this launching pad, in order to group forces, in order to put together their plans. And from there, then you have another problem. There's another problem that helped precipitate this, where it was the Iraqi army itself. I've actually talked to a few people where they will kind of throw out a little conspiracy theory where they think that the Iraqi army deliberately left Mosul, which was taken by ISIS and some other Baathi-style militias and other Sunni jihadi groups, but primarily ISIS. You know, they were saying, well, the Iraqi army deliberately failed because, you know, they were told to pull out. They were told to this. You know, I don't have any evidence confirming that. It's an interesting little theory, but, you know, I do think what that kind of hides, though, is how poor the Iraqi army, despite billions of dollars being poured into it, how poor they were as an actual fighting force, where they really just could not project themselves or stay, you know, stand their ground. And ISIS had been able to develop really combat hardened, a lot of combat hardened veterans. They were very well trained, and they were also well equipped because they've been capturing different Assad stores, you know, over in Syria. And they've also been shipping some of their own stuff in. So the counter to that was a tad flawed. And the interesting thing is, I mean, if you really want to see ISIS's combat effectiveness, certain elite groups that are tied with the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, meaning Iran's kind of revolutionary vanguard force that functions like Green Berets, if you will, for the United States, but have a little bit more of an interesting extra stuff that they do. You know, they sent in people from Kataib Hezbollah. I mean, this was reported by Kataib Hezbollah itself into Mosul. And these forces, you know, were supposedly flown into Mosul airport. And from the airport, they engaged ISIS forces, but they didn't seem to have succeeded. And these are supposed to be much more elite forces. These are some of the same forces. I mean, Kataib Hezbollah is on the U.S. terror list. But they were regularly attacking the U.S. during the occupation of Iraq and during the Iraq War from 2003 on. So they've also had a hard time facing these kind of Sunni jihadi forces. So it says a lot about combat abilities and the ability to project them within Iraq, because even before this is yet another one of these pieces of the puzzle. Maliki, being the sectarian leader that he is, he didn't just want to crush ISIS. No, he wanted to crush an entire Sunni protest movement. If you remember this back in December when he really, really, really launched it, he had the full support of the Iranian proxy groups that are based in Iraq. And from there, he just tried to advance and take a lot of these different areas. And if you remember, Fallujah fell and the government forces could not take it back. There were chunks of Anbar province which fell and they couldn't take them back. There were militants from Asayi Bahal al-Haq and the Badr organization, both are Iranian proxies that were fighting in Anbar and taking casualties. So it says a lot about kind of this progression that it's been this. It's almost like a mouse nibbling at a piece of cheese at first, and it just keeps nibbling at the piece of cheese. But imagine this piece of cheese then crumbles, like a huge chunk of it just crumbles, and there's still the rest of it left. And that mouse is still, nibbling away at that cheese. That's kind of how Iraq is right now.
So going back to Syria quickly, how much of a role do you think Syria has played a part in this crisis in Iraq with this Shia jihad that's taking place in Syria? I mean, you did mention, you alluded to, it's been a very good ground for them to train and gain more forces and so forth. So how much has that provided this safe haven, this opportunity to prepare for this?
Well, I think that we need to look at kind of the Iranian strategy using their proxies first. And I hope that the other things that I laid out give a little background to it, because when you're looking at that, starting in December, there was reports of certain redeployments that followed the announcement of Maliki's offensive in Anbar. And there were certain key units that were deployed around the site of Zainab Shrine that were claimed to have been redeployed. And then I saw more reports of this in January. Then pictures started to surface of certain fighters who were in Syria who were attached with these Iranian Shia Iraqi proxies that were coming back. So there is a level of redeployment. I think that you can read into this any way you want, but clearly the kind of Iranian puppet masters on the other end, they understood that they would need forces back in Iraq. Coinciding with that, there was also their own independent recruiting effort. And this was rather public, where they had set up certain offices, where they had set up certain recruitment venues using a multitude of different media platforms to get people to sign up. And they were signing up for what they called not sacred defense, but defense of the homeland. This kind of changed a little bit over the course of time, and eventually when ISIS really made its hard push in Mosul, not only did they say that it was the defense of the homeland, but then they also added in what they called the sacred defense. Now, the sacred defense is what they were calling their fight in Syria. So they essentially combined, the narrative in terms of narrative, they combined the conflicts and said, look, this is all about defending our shrines, and these forces that we are deploying, they're the real ones that are doing it. So you have that angle of it. But the redeployments and the recruitment that was going on happened long before Maliki, Sistani, Muqtada al-Sadr, Hakim, any of these leaders came out and said, we are going to start recruiting popular groups to counter ISIS. They were doing it for months. And when I say months, I mean sometimes as early as January, February. I saw a lot of it in March, more of it in April, kind of a harder core kind of recruitment effort in April. And then again, it flowed a little bit more in May. So there was a run-up to this, and there was a run-up on that side. And when I look at it, you can read it a few ways. Was it, the Iranian proxy forces, did they really want ISIS to advance so far and take this territory so that they could better solidify control over the essentially rump portions of Iraq that are Shia dominated? Or did they have some other plan? Or did they just want to immediately start pumping fighters into Iraq? And the interesting thing is, if you have a recruitment effort that's been going on for that long, when you look at something comparative, like let's say Syria, then you would see the effects that those recruits were having on the battlefield. And in Iraq, you wouldn't really see that. So it's almost as if they were just kept waiting in this kind of reserve force. I can't really confirm anything with that, but it's just kind of the running speculation that I have, because I didn't really see all that much combat activity. But kind of tying this back around to Syria, the Syrian civil war helped push a lot of the sentiment on both sides. This conflict is now becoming highly sectarian. There's no denying it. When you have such a big wig as Sistani, who's coming out and saying that there needs to be a defense. And by the way, his fatwa was very measured. If you read it, it's a very, very measured document, typical of Sistani's style. What it does say is, what you can read into it and what many are reading into it is, this is a now Shia defense against these quote-unquote takfiris, these different Sunni jihadi groups. That's how a number of people have been reading into it. So I don't really know how one can turn that off. Sistani could, issue some other fatwas at some other time and try to recall the forces, or, who knows. But I think the genie's been let out of the bottle, and this has been kind of a progression that's been going on since the Syrian civil war really broke out.
And do we have any idea of the number of the Iranian proxies that are involved in this conflict?
We can count them out together. I'm just going to name them out. And there are a few new ones. I can kind of go through the different groups. The major ones that many people know, you have Kataib Hezbollah, which is on the State Department Foreign Terrorist Organization list. You have Asayib Ahlal Haq. You have the Badr Organization. Badr Organization has almost completely infiltrated certain chunks of the Iraqi government. So those are three main ones. Then you have a newer one that was formed between April and May 2013 called Kataib Sayyid al-Shuhada. Their leader, he goes by the name of Mustafa Khazali. That's his nom de guerre. He actually ran for parliament in Basra, and he won. So he is also on Maliki's list. He's like on state of law list. So that should kind of tell you how tied in they are. But Kataib Sayyid al-Shuhada was a very, they a very brutal kind of militia. And when I say that, in Syria, I knew them best because they were the guys who would always put the most brutal images on their social media, their regular internet media pages, and the stuff that they would just generally promote. I remember doing an estimate. I wrote an article for Brown Moses' blog in, I think, October, and I wanted to go through all the pictures because it was like something I kept noticing. It was always something that was far more grotesque than the last. It was just really, really brutal stuff, and I guess I counted somewhere like 30% of the images they had just put up in a short time span were these brutal types of images. So, imagine if you will, that, you're a Sunni, they would look at that and say, oh my God, these guys are really tough and really brutal and really sectarian. So there's that group. Then there's another group that announced their presence on the field, led by Akram Kabi. And he was an Asayib Ahlal Haq commander. The claim has gone out that he split from Asayib Ahlal Haq. I don't buy that at all, because he clearly says that his group adheres to Wilayat al-Faqih, which means that they are allies. They're intrinsically linked to, the Iranian proxy groups, they always try pulling this. Oh, well, he split off, so that means we have no connection. Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Please. It's just you use this one to to kind of, you know, project yourself so that you can cover this group, which is actually covering that group, which is actually covering that group. For a lot of analysts, you know, it's done deliberately so that if, you know, we're sitting here looking at it and you go, what is this that I'm looking at? What? Oh, so that's connected to this, connected to this, connected to this. I mean, you need one of those, you actually need one of the computer formulas where I work to really put it all together and put all the lines on the paper. So I mean, there's this group. So this newer group formed by Akram Kabi is called Harakat Hezb Allah al-Nujaba, sometimes known as Harakat al-Nujaba. It was very, very active in Aleppo, became very well known for its activities there, and also is active in parts of Damascus. And they have other little sub-militias that are – you kind of have their own name brand like Liwa Ammar ibn Yasser, and then Liwa al-Hammad, and then there's Liwa al-Imam al-Hassan. So they have groups like that, and they also are fed by a number of other different, you know, fed fighters by a number of different and newer political parties that are also Iranian proxies but do not have an official militia themselves. So after that, we then have Faylaq Wad al-Sadiq. That's another group that claims that it was around during the Iraq War, though there's hardly any evidence of it actually existing. And they claim to be kind of a Hezbollah-modeled group. There's overlap on that, too, because one of their commanders in my Washington Institute policy piece, this is a guy who I had, you know, his kind of social media presence I became very interested in because he always had something new up. And I, when I first found him, I was studying Liwa Ammar ibn Yasser, and he was named multiple times as a commander in Aleppo for them. But the strange thing is, the minute he got back to Iraq, and yes, he did go back to Iraq earlier in 2014, he participated in a protest of a newspaper that, you know, it was actually, they published a cartoon that criticized Khamenei. And while at the protest, not only did he have a sidearm on him, but he was also in an ISOF uniform, meaning Iraqi Special Operations Forces, which should tell you, you know, there are multiple loyalties going on here. After that protest, it was reported that he was deployed to Abu Ghraib, you know, the place where the prison abuse actually occurred, and there's still a prison there where a number of high profile inmates are held. But he was deployed out there, and when he was deployed out there, he was deployed as a section leader for Faylaq Wad al-Sadiq, and they said that he was the leader of Kataib al-Zahra. And this was his new organization that he was leading. So it just kind of, I think it shows some of the modularity of a lot of this, where they will just pick and choose, and, oh, you're the leader of this, and you just came from this, you're leader of that. It happens quite a bit. I mean, I think the best relation I've ever heard is, you know, if you look at CPUSA, Communist Party USA, you know, they would start a committee for this, a committee for that, a committee for this, you know, 75 different committees for 75 you know, different things, but all things that the Communist Party wanted to support. And guess what? They have the same three guys running it. It's essentially like that in many respects in terms of sharing the fighters. Then there's another group called Sariya Taliya al-Khurasani. And this group kind of made its name known back in the fall of 2013. They have been active, but I haven't seen too much about them in Iraq, but I have seen reports of them being deployed to Samarra and some other cities. Then there's also Liwa Abu Fadl al-Abbas. And so Liwa Abu Fadl al-Abbas, this is another really interesting thing. Qasim al-Tai, who is a sheikh, he's kind of a well-known sheikh, who used to be a Sadrist, meaning he was in that same ideological grouping that Sadiq al-Sadr was part of. This is Muqtada's father, excuse me. And he was also tied with Muqtada for a little while, but he split off. He embraced the Iranian revolutionary concept of Wilayat al-Faqih, which is the ideology they are trying to spread. And he, you know, it was reported that he was a prime leader, you know, a guy who really gave a lot of support to Liwa Abu Fadl al-Abbas in Damascus. But there were disagreements within that group because the group was initially founded as a sort of popular committee with you know, there were Iraqi Shia who were living in the area, and there were also Shia from Syria. The commander, Abu Ajib, was reportedly originally from Idlib. So there were disagreements because some of the Iraqi fighters did not want to fight under Abu Ajib's command. And so this other, Liwa Abu Fadl al-Abbas, kind of eventually came into existence, and it's gone by different names. Most of the time they just refer to themselves as you know, that name, as Lafa, to use the initialism. But in Iraq, they've kind of formed their own little separate organization. Yes, they do utilize some of the fighters from Syria, and a number of these fighters I've seen are attached to ISF units or ISOF units or Iraqi army units. It's kind of an interesting patchwork. And they've also been deployed to a few areas in Baghdad, Samarra, and a few other places. So that's kind of the general rundown of most of the groups. I may even recall one or two. I'm sorry, I've just been all of them. When I try to put them together, they create a new group every other day, essentially. So it's, you know, it's a new one you got to keep track of, and you got to see what kind of imagery goes out. And I don't want to make. I kind of need to seal this right here. Just because a new group is formed, it doesn't really mean it is a combat effective organization. It doesn't mean it's even a real group per se. They may have reported leaders. They may have, you know, actions that they have done. But at times I've noticed that, you know, there is no real separation of, you know, the forces. It's not like, hi, I'm standing next to a Harakat Hezbollah al-Nujaba guy, and I am in, you know, Asai Bahl al-Hawk. Sometimes it's just shared membership, and later in time, when it needs to be cast in a narrative form, then the web proxy masters, if you will. I thought that was clever. I guess it wasn't. But you know, those guys will come forward and then say, okay, well, look, we can separate this guy out, and he's now in this organization, and we made sure when we took a picture of him, he was wearing this patch. You know, the Iranians have a vested interest in making it look as if they have the widest network of support as humanly possible, particularly coming out of Iraq, where, you know, it's not as many people who adhere to their ideological concepts. And also, you know, Najaf is there. Because Najaf is there, the religious traditions are radically different than what, you know, they're trying to promote in Qom. So there's a lot of different competing interests here, and it's not, I mean, it's not even just on the religious angle, it's also on the political angle. If you're showing that, you know, there's this multitude of groups, they all essentially believe in the same thing, but they're different groups. One, if you're a foreign, you know, a foreign entity, let's say you're the United States and you want to keep track of, you know, terrorists and whatnot, if you've only listed, let's say, Kitab Hezbollah, and the Badr organization is fighting alongside Kitab Hezbollah, and they are feeding them fighters at times to use, and, you know, they had multiple memberships here and there, it makes things very, very confusing. Beyond that, if I'm, let's say, running any of these groups in an election, it also creates the perception that the support base is far larger than it may actually, you know, be in reality. So it is part of a grand strategy to have kind of this multiplicity, if you will.
And so since last Friday's fatwa by Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, today, I think it came out today, but don't quote me on that, there was a great article on the Christian Science Monitor about how after this call to take up arms, there has been this huge increase in signing up for protecting Iraq and Shiite shrines and so forth. Whether it's with the Iraqi army or different Shiite militias, how is this going to play into the whole situation that we have already? I mean, all these people are getting armed. We've got Shiites, Sunni, ISIS. So let's look at the Sunni side, but how is this going to play into this, the bigger scheme of things?
Well, if we're looking at the big picture, Sistani clearly doesn't want a sectarian issue or sectarian fighting. You know, I'm saying I am fighting you because I am Shia. You know, I'm fighting the Sunnis because I am a Shia. You know, that kind of perception. But there's a lot of other, you know, action going on. I mean, I didn't know if you wanted to focus on Sunnis. I mean, I heard that, but I guess kind of going forward, if we're just talking about the Shia groups, a lot of organizations have done their best to, I guess, take. They've tried to benefit off of Sistani's announcement. See, Sistani was very clear. Sistani said, join police forces and the army. This was clarified more than once through more than one, you know, different sources that were out there talking about the fatwa. So, I mean, now that that's kind of established, why is it these other militia groups are also recruiting? The Islamic Supreme Council of Iraq, which is actually led by Amar al-Hakim, Sayyid Amar al-Hakim, he actually has reestablished a militia of his. And if you really focus on that group, you know, they look combat equipped. They claim that they had 50,000 new recruits. And the funny thing is the recruitment that's used for them features Sistani heavily, really quite heavily. For the Iranian proxy groups, they have come out and while they are no fans of Sistani and they have tried to marginalize him, they do understand the reality. And the reality is that many people follow him, more people than, you know, that follow Khamenei. And because of that, they have tried to wrap Sistani in with Khamenei and kind of create this unified image. You see the marjas, they agree and everything's okay and we're going to go forward. And, you know, we're so lucky that we're coming around to seeing our position, that kind of narrative is being forwarded on it. And I mean, I saw a lot of that in Syria, you know, with the Syrian conflict as well, where they actually would try to go out of their way and claim that Sistani was also calling for the defense of Sayyidah Zainab, when in fact he never did. So, you know, now they actually have something that's really down there on paper. But where is this going? This is the bigger problem. Just because Sistani issued a fatwa, you also have other groups. You have these Iranian-backed groups, which have been engaged historically in what was essentially ethnic cleansing, where they were pushing Sunni populations out of sections of Baghdad and out of other areas in Iraq. You know, they're not listening to Sistani's orders, and, you know, they didn't listen before. They did their own thing, and they're very, very intertwined with the government. So it remains to be seen how they're going to take this. Is this going to be morphed into a more sectarian-style war by them? Are they going to influence other forces? Then you have other groups. You have Muqtada al-Sadr, who mobilized different sections of Jaish al-Mahdi, the old Mahdi army. And he used kind of the old recruitment networks to do this. So he was using mosques. He was using the old recruiters who were going from neighborhood to neighborhood to get people. He started a very specifically oriented shrine defense group called Saray al-Salam. And this group, there wasn't really much detail on it, but they were specifically focused just on shrine defense. So, you know, remembering or kind of if we're going to notice the history of Jaish al-Mahdi, they too have been engaged in quite a bit of sectarian warfare. And who really controls them? Is Muqtada al-Sadr going to put his foot down and really manage their activities? Are they still as disparate as they were during the Iraq War? Has more organization been put down? So it's really hard to see, like, what's going to be the end result of this. I don't think that the majority of Shia really just, you know, want to ethnically cleanse Sunnis who are just living in their areas. I don't think they want to do that. But when you have kind of this drumbeat to this kind of a war, and ISIS, you know, they are clearly propelling this war in a far more sectarian direction. They want this. They want this to be a Sunni Shia, you know, fight to the death. And because of that, you have a lot of different. Well, you have a lot of different perceptions that will pop up. And now that the people are on the warpath on both sides, it's another one of these kinds of things where I'd respond, well, remains to be seen what will happen. But it's not the best thing that's really going on. But, you know, if you're on the Shia side of things, you're looking at this and saying, well, finally, you know, there are recruits and we can defend ourselves and we can take back Iraq. I mean, I've seen some of that sentiment. But what certain groups mean by quote unquote take back Iraq, well, what is it they want to create? You know, what is it they want in the end? Are they going to cleanse certain areas? Don't know. It's a possibility. Do they want to kill a lot of people? Don't know. It's a possibility. We already know that ISIS doesn't really care about, you know, they actually, I mean, they don't care about how many people they kill. They're more than happy to spread the narrative that they are the most brutal out there, and you know they're going to kill anyone who opposes them, and also destroy holy shrines that are important because this they believe is their purpose. So you know you're dealing with two different entities that you know both feel that they are quote unquote defending themselves. And I think, you know, you got to kind of draw the line where it goes from defense to something else, you know, something dirtier, something more brutal. And I think ISIS has, of course, crossed that line. And I think that certain elements within the broader Shia kind of militia struggle have also gone over that line over the past couple of months.
Today, al-Sistani made another statement in the Friday sermons. And he called for Nouri al-Maliki to pretty much step down, pointing that Iraq needed a more effective government, which is a pretty strong statement, I would say. So I was wondering if we could look at the idea of the Shia political leaders, so Maliki, Sadr, Hakim, versus political Shia religious leaders. And is there a division in what either of these two groups want? Is there a good unity? What's happening between these two worlds?
There's always divisions. If we're talking about the Hawza in Najaf, then you're talking about an institution. You know, I'm gonna totally steal something that somebody said at this AEI panel that I was on, and I can't remember who said it, but it was great. If we're talking about institutions, the modern Iraqi state, their modern institution is just that. It is modern. How old is the Najaf Hawza? In terms of influence and in terms of power, it's very powerful. However, if I'm running a political party, you have to remember Muqtada al-Sadr did not really bend to the demands of Sistani before. I mean, he has, but early on, he was very crafty in trying to win a place at the table. And I think all of these players have won their place at the table. And I think a lot of them have done so using very, very aggressive and militant means. I would say that in terms of following what Sistani might say, you already have opposition to Maliki within the Shia establishment. You already have Hakim. You already have Muqtada al-Sadr. Those groups, there's a reason why they mobilized at different times around Maliki. Sistani came much later because, well, obvious reasons, you know, he had to wait until the crisis had really hit a boiling point. Hakim followed Sistani, even though I'm quite sure that his group understood the existential threat of ISIS. Sadr, he kind of tiptoed around the issue where he formed that shrine defense unit, but was, you know, here and there and everywhere about, you know, restarting Jaish al-Mahdi. So I guess kind of going back to the main question, the interrelation between these different elements, it's there's been a lot of push and pull. You know, I think it can really go anywhere because if you remember during the Iraq War and during the really bloody parts of it, there were people in the Hawza who were being assassinated, Sistani representatives. Even today, a lot of people don't know who did that. There's no real evidence as to who did it or why. There's a lot of thinking that it was, you know, internal. It was an internal Shia issue. Could that happen again? There's always a possibility. Judging from Maliki understands where his support comes from. His support does not necessarily come from Sistani. That's more of an addendum level of support. He's still popular in a lot of different corridors of you know, the Shia living in Iraq, and that can't be downplayed. Beyond that, he has a powerful state backer, which is Iran, and he also has their military capabilities via their proxies in that country. So that gives him another level of power. So I don't really know where it'll really go. I don't want to speculate, but you know, judging from relatively recent history, it could go a few places.
So why don't we focus back on ISIS? And I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about what the reaction has been from this perspective of the Shia militias, the religious hierarchy, and Iran.
Okay. Well, Iran and their Shia militias, their proxies, have kind of constantly cast ISIS in the same light over and over and over again, that they are kind of the worst of the worst when it comes to the evil Takfiris, the evil Nawasib that are here to wipe out Shiism and that need to be, you know, stomped into the ground and destroyed. So that's been just a continuing theme for a while. And there's really no light between, like, there's no separation between Iran and the proxies in terms of propelling the same narrative. The other groups in Iraq, the other Shia groups, there is no love for ISIS. They hate ISIS. They and the Iraqi Shia proxies of Iran they've even been involved in making songs criticizing ISIS, and this has been going on since, you know, like last year. It's nothing new. I mean, it's really nothing new. On Hakim's television station, I think it's Furat TV, I was watching it a few days ago, and they actually had this catchy little song that was on there. It was just totally bashing ISIS, and they're calling on people to be recruited for the new kind of Islamic Supreme Council of Iraq militia, and, you know, fight ISIS and defend Iraq. It's interesting that, you know, the majority of the Shia groups, their concept of Iraq, and I'm going for the Iranian-backed ones as well, they play this kind of nationalist card where they are doing this fight for Iraq. They keep pushing it. Some mean it a little bit more than others. If we're talking about Iranian proxy groups, you know, their concept of the nation state, often it's just rhetoric just to kind of win the favor of people living in the country. But these other organizations, because they are tied more so in an ideological fashion and a number of other ways to Iraq, they will often kind of project this, you know, we are defending the nation of Iraq, and they include the Kurds in that, and they include the Sunnis, and you'll just see the whole map of Iraq. But if you really want to read into it, I'm sure some on the quote unquote Sunni side are looking at that and they say, well, see, they're trying to take the entire map of Iraq. They want to kick us out. They want to control everything. And I've seen sentiment like that. That's kind of the general deal in terms of dealing with ISIS on a clerical level. During the recruitment, I thought this was astonishing, and, you know, a ton of people who were following social media were noticing this, where there were just this gigantic amount of photos of different clerical leaders. It didn't matter how old they were, whether they were octogenarians or they were in their 30s. If they were wearing, you know, these turbans, they were out there willing to fight, particularly after Sistani's order to go out and fight. And you just see these shots of them in camouflage gear and holding a rifle, and, you know, they're ready to go. The sentiment is there, and I would say in more junior clerical ranks that they need to, you know, pick up the rifle and go. This is a theme that's been promoted, though I would say that other clerics have actually fled the country. Some of them have. I remember one cleric, and I can't recall his name right now, but he actually left for Iran, and he told his followers to keep fighting in Iraq while he left. So just like in any other community, you get splits in there, and, you know, different people pushing their own different agendas. But in general, if we're talking about the kind of Hawza and Najaf, then they are, you know, they're all in. They really want to go for this, and they understand that a defensive operation and kind of a huge mobilization of their followers is necessary.
And focusing on Iran now, what do you see as the role of Iran in this crisis? I mean, we know they have these proxy militias, but what other things do they have their hand in?
Well, there have been the reports of IRGC on the ground. I was actually the first one in English to put out the piece on that IRGC fighter who was supposedly killed, the first martyr, the IRGC martyr from Iraq. So there's that, but there's also the political links, and it ties into their proxy efforts. I actually believe that they are so embedded now into certain pieces of the establishment that's there, meaning the army establishment, the military establishment, internal security, government with Maliki. I mean, there were reports that Qasem Soleimani was setting up the defenses of Baghdad. when you hear things like that, when he's visiting the country and telling his proxies, you know, here's the time, you know, get ready, it says quite a bit. So their role in this, you know, they're trying to dominate the Maliki rump state, and they're doing it via Maliki. Excuse me. I don't really think there's much denying that, because Maliki hasn't really done all that much to hide it, and the forces that he's using, which are these Iranian proxies, they don't hide it either. They haven't hidden their support for Maliki for years now. Like since the beginning of 2013, you'd always see this kind of same theme, the same pro-Maliki theme. So they understand that their eggs are all in this kind of collective basket. And that's the way they're going forward. Now, here's the interesting thing. If you're really looking at kind of the big picture, the majority of Shia do not support, you know, Iran's efforts. They don't support, you know, the spread of Wilayat al-Faqih. They don't support Khamenei as their religious leader, as their marja. They support Sistani. But the thing is, because they have become so embedded, because they've infiltrated so well, that they can now play this angle. You know, oh, you don't like the government? Guess what? We are the government. So you're going to have to coalesce around us. Because if you don't, then you're ceding, you know, territory. You're ceding you might even, you know, give your lives to ISIS if you don't get behind us. And one of the regular themes that's been presented by those who wish to push Iran's position in the country, they'll say, well, we accept aid from anybody. And I think anybody in any situation like this where there's an existential threat would. I mean, you would. I still remember talking to Christians in Lebanon, you know, members of certain Christian groups, and I said, well, how do you explain away, you know, getting aid from the Israelis? And this kind of constant response, I got it out of like five people in different forms, was, we would take aid from the devil if it would save our people. Mm-hmm. And of course, my phone is going off ringing Yazine every now. So anyway, that's kind of the general – that's – the general theme where they are willing to take aid, and you know, these Iranian groups are willing to push that.
And just for our listeners, if you want to read any more about the IRGC martyr in Iraq, that will be on the Hezbollah Cavalcade website. I actually read that today, and it's very detailed, very interesting. So, Philip, to kind of wrap up this fascinating conversation, I've really enjoyed it. I'm going to hand the table over to you if there's a last statement you'd like to make or something that we haven't touched on that you think is important. So it's in your ballpark, so to speak.
Well, I think we've touched on a lot. I hope that I didn't go off on too many tangents. I kind of do that a lot. But, you know, when we're looking at Iraq, there's a lot of diversity there in terms of the quote-unquote Shia militia. Shia militia is a very, very hard term to use for just about anything, because you do have the Iranian proxies, you have militias that belong to this political party, you have popular groups that belong to a certain proxy. It's a complex mess. If we're kind of looking forward into Iraq, how effective these groups will be, again, it's another one of these things where I want to say it remains to be seen, but it's certainly – this is an issue to be watched. I mean, the issue dealing with – Shia development, both in terms of their perception of, you know, connections to Iraq, their dealings with Maliki, how they group together in order to form a defense, all of these matters are very, very important. And it will affect kind of the future for American policymaking in the region, because if you've noticed these overtures to Iran, that didn't just come out of nowhere. But there's a lot going on. There's a lot. I mean, I really wish I could just offer a succinct, you know, clean sentence, but I can't. My head is like filled with little butterflies floating around.
Yeah, it's a very complicated and developing situation that really could snowball in a lot of different directions. So I completely agree with you with that. Well, thank you so much for spending your late Friday afternoon with us, and we'll have to have you on the show again.
Thanks
a
lot.
And we will continue producing shows for you listeners, so stay tuned.